Welcome to the Aerospace Advantage Podcast. I'm your host, John Slickbaum. As you know, we've hosted a number of individuals here on the podcast, but I can guarantee none have had such an incredible set of career and life experiences as today's guest, General Kevin Chili Chilton. He joined the Mitchell team this fall and is the senior voice at our Space Power Advantage Research Center. And here's what's so incredible about his career. He's covered an immense range of experiences, any one of which would have marked a highly successful career. He attended the Air Force Academy, he flew F-4s, F-15s, and then moved to the test pilot community. Later served as a NASA astronaut, going to space three times, including as the commander of STS-76, and also served as the deputy program manager for operations for the International Space Station program. After his time at NASA, he came back to the Air Force, where he rose through multiple command positions, including commander of Air Force Space Command and commander of U.S. Strategic Command. That's a lot to fit into a 34-year career in uniform. I'm not sure where he found time to sleep, nor has he slowed down after retiring from the Air Force. He's been involved in several arenas, ranging from work with federally funded research and development centers to industry and now Mitchell. So with that, sir, thanks so much for being here today. And I've got to tell you, I watched your career ever since I was in the Air Force, and you really stood out as an inspiration to guys down at my level. So it's an honor to spend time with you here today.
Oh, thanks, Slick. So kind of you. It's really great to join you today. So I'm looking forward to our chat.
Absolutely. Well, sir, we got to start off at something that hits close to home. So can you talk to us about your vision for Mitchell's Space Power Advantage Research Center and what motivated you to join us here at Mitchell and some of the effects that you'd like to see the team realize?
Sure. Well, I think the Space Power Advantage Research Center's fundamental mission is education. And we do that by writing thoughtful articles. We do that by interviewing leaders, particularly in the Space Force, to help them get their word out, their vision out, and understand where we need to go as a nation with regard to our national security interests in space. I think also we provide a forum. We want to provide a forum for debate, because I truly believe no one has the answer. I'm certainly not one who has the answer for every issue. And there's often two and three sides to every story. And to provide a non-threatening environment where topics can be cussed and discussed, if you will, because I think out of that friction comes better decisions and better understandings of what opportunities are out there that can bolster the strength of our national security. So I'm excited to be a part of the team here. We have a great team here, and I'm looking forward to participating as we go forward.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, General Deptula and everybody else has really been able to harness some great folks. So one of the things, and you kind of mentioned it, but just getting your perspective on what MySpark's going to do that's different compared to what other entities are contributing to the conversation, and talking about, everybody from the Space Force itself to long-established research and development centers, like, things like RAND, Aerospace Corporation, and other think tanks. So what do you think our unique piece to the equation will be?
Well, I certainly value the FFRDCs like RAND. They do really in-depth studies. They take on some really hard problems, and it's not to suggest that we won't discuss hard topics as well. But a good example was today our Space Power Forum. We talked to three Delta commanders and, giving them a voice, giving them an opportunity to talk about what their mission is, removes a lot of fog from the discussions that we have that's just naturally created when you stand up a new organization. You rename organizations from wings to deltas, you flatten the organizations, you combine organizations, you bring Army and Navy units into the new Space Force, integrate them in. I think we have the opportunity to be a little broader in the topics we talk about, and I think we are a little more flexible. We're not necessarily relying on someone to ask us to do a study and fund a study. We can be creative and probe ourselves out there and ask questions that maybe stir more broader and general debates that, again, I hope will be very beneficial.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that's a good point that nobody's asking us to do this work, right? So it's nice that we have the freedom to kind of explore a bit. But I want to get on to some of the fun stuff, sir. I know we did have a chance to talk on a previous episode, some fun flying stories, but I want to get to square one with you and just ask you the basic question of what motivated you to join the Air Force and pursue flying?
This is kind of embarrassing, because I, in all honesty, I didn't do it with a service perspective in mind. It was pretty selfish reasons. I grew up in the shadow of LA International Airport. My mother had been a stewardess for American Airlines in the 1940s. And my father was an aeronautical engineer for Douglas Aircraft, flight test engineer, and then got into the space business during Apollo and national security space later in his career. So we had this aviation bent in the family. My mother's best friends for life were her fellow stewardesses, and we called them all aunt and uncles, and one who lived nearby us, her husband was a pilot for United. So, you know, growing up near the airport, my school, my grammar school is at the approach end of the North Runway. My high school is at the departure end of the North Runway. You know, when I wasn't paying attention to the teacher, I was looking out the window watching airplanes take off or land. And it just, flight always interested me. And even though today I've had plenty of aeronautical engineering courses, I see an airplane fly by, I got to stop and look. And it's still magic to me that we can put these huge hunks of metal in the sky so gracefully. So I wanted to become a pilot, and I couldn't figure out how to get flying lessons. And one day, one summer day, when we'd call up all our buddies and see what we were going to do that day, whether it was baseball, football, or what we really wanted to do was go to the beach, one of my buddies said he has his older brother, who I'd never met before, was home from college. And so I jumped in the car with them and asked his brother where he was going to college. He said he was going to a place called the Air Force Academy. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, as a college, you go there, and after you graduate, they teach you how to fly jets. I said to him, well, do you have to be in the Air Force after you do that? He said, he laughed, said, yeah, you have a commitment. I said, well, after that, can you become a United Airline pilot? He said, yeah, some guys do that. I was about 12 years old, and that day I said, well, I guess I know how I'm going to get my flying lessons. But so, I mean, long answer to your question. I wanted to learn how to fly, and I didn't know how else I could do it. I wanted to be an airline pilot, but you know, a funny thing happened on the way to the airlines. I fell in love with the United States Air Force, and they had to finally throw me out after almost 35 years.
Well, it's pretty incredible, sir. Thanks for sharing that. You know, and that's just another testimonial to mentorship, right? I mean, if you didn't have this young man when you were 12 to talk about the Air Force and the Air Force Academy, you know, might have lost one more huge contributor to aerospace. So I love hearing that, sir, and I'm sure the audience really appreciates that. And that, you know, that's the burden that we have as folks in the aerospace realm, is we've got to share this with the next gen. So that's what I'm really passionate about. But sir, I want to hop on further, looking at your bio, you entered the operational community at a really unique time. It was 1978, and not only was the Air Force moving aggressively out of implementing lessons learned from Vietnam, but we also now had a new set of fourth-gen fighters entering, and the Cold War was pronounced, to say the least. So can you talk to us about what it was like flying in this era as a young officer?
Yeah, I mean, so my first operational assignment in the RF4 was to Kinin Air Base in Okinawa, Japan. But our principal warfighting mission, what we trained for, and in fact we kept 25% of the squadron personnel and aircraft at Osan Air Base in Korea, and that's, we were training for, well, first to deter a fight on the Korean Peninsula, but if one came, to fight and win it. And of course, it was in the middle of the Cold War, but this was not totally disconnected from that, given their sponsorship in North Korea. So, you know, it was serious business. I would posit that the feeling I had at the time was that we were not in a particularly superior position relative to the North Koreans at that time. That certainly U.S. forces were in pretty darn good shape, but when you looked at the numbers staring at you across the border and the readiness of the South Koreans to defend themselves, it was going to be a tough fight. And so it was serious business, and we took it seriously. It was great fun, because I love flying. I love flying fast and low. And that was the mission in the RF4. But, you know, we were very focused on. While I was serving over there in the RF, the president of South Korea was assassinated. I mean, you talk about tensions ratcheting up almost instantaneously. 2 years before I got over there was a tree cutting incident in the DMZ where they killed, the North Koreans killed some of our soldiers there, doing authorized work in the up there by Panmunjom. So, I mean, it was tense. And we felt really, we spent a lot of time in the vault studying the threat and studying the plans, and took our mission over there very seriously.
You bet. I appreciate talking about your time there. But then you transitioned to the F-15. I understand this is when you first met our dean of the Mitchell Institute, now, you know, Lieutenant General Deptula. Can you talk about what it was like when you first met him? I'm sure you guys were probably like captains or something, right?
Yes, and of course, Dave had already had a operational tour in the F-15 at Holloman Air Force Base. So it was interesting that, I mean, I was so lucky, one, timing-wise, to be where I was, but also because I had such great leadership in the RF-4 squadron, the 15th Tac Reconnaissance Squadron, both my flight commander, operations officer, squadron commander. What happened was I got over there in 1978, and on an 18-month unaccompanied tour, about 3 months after I'd been there, I realized how fortunate I was, and I asked if I could extend to make it, which you could, up to 2 years was maximum. So I extended my tour. I was single. That's fall of 78. We roll into 79, and there were five F-4 squadrons when I arrived in the 18th Tech Fighter Wing, and four of them went away and turned into three brand new F-15 squadrons. I mean, these were the first production C models right off the production line. And I'll never forget the day they arrived, because they brought the airplanes in. They brought the whole wing in from Eglin Air Force Base, where they spun up. And that was a bunch of people who had had previous tours in the F-15, like Dave, and also some of the F-4 Phantom D model guys and C model guys at Kadena had gone back and taken the TX course and checked out. So they're very experienced fighter pilots, first tour in the F-15. And that whole wing of airplanes came in and landed. It was just so exciting. Well, the RF-4 was the only F-4 squadron left there at Okinawa. And our commander went up the chain of command and said, you know, it might be kind of motivational to let an RF-4 guy convert to the F-15. And that idea was accepted by the ops group commander, or the DO at the time, the wing commander, and kind of sent up to PACAF headquarters. And they said, sure, here's the criteria. Got to be an instructor pilot, got to be at most a 2 or 3 year captain, because we want them to have some runway ahead of them and a new airplane career or a new path. And those are general criteria. So there was five of us nominated to do that. And then the decision got punted down the road 6 months. I'm a young captain. I don't know all the ins and outs of that. I just know that my squadron commander went to bat to make sure that that slip wasn't going to affect the decision. But the other four guys were all on accompanied tours, had been there for 3 years already, and now they're faced with extending to 3.5 years on a 1 in 5 chance they're going to get picked. And, you know, it was just too hard a decision for them to make. It was almost like the whole program was in the balance. And frankly, they all PCS'd back to America, which left me as the last man standing. I wouldn't have been there had I not extended in the first place. So it was just, I was so lucky in that regard, timing-wise. And again, to have this leadership that pushed me up the chain. One final thing in the story is my understanding at the time, and I never really pulled the thread on it to see what the ground truth was, but when they sent my name to Tactical Air Command at the time to say, to have orders cut for me to go to Luke to learn how to fly the F-15, they got a message back that said RF-4 pilots are not allowed to convert from the RF-4 to the F-15 unless they've flown a regular F-4, which we took a little umbrage with in the RF-4 community. And of course, I didn't know anything about this. Well, it got into a little contest between PACAF and TAC, and the answer was I was allowed to go to Luke Air Force Base, join a TX class, a transition class, but I was not allowed to fly the airplane, and I was not allowed to take a simulator even. I could just do the academics, because it wasn't allowed in TAC. So, you know, they said, well, you can sit in a chair. So I sat through all the academics, the slideshows and all that, to learn the systems of the F-15, took the tests. But then I hated the fact I couldn't fly or even get in the sim. And one day I was over watching a sim being given to one of my classmates who was doing a transition, going to go to Kadena as well as me. And I'm sitting there talking to the guys on console there, the Singer employees that ran the simulator. And they said, well, how come you're never in the sim? And I told them my story, and they said, they looked at me and said, hey, I'll tell you what. We shut the sim down at 5 p.m., and then we go into a maintenance cycle until the morning. So we're on shift. You know, someone's on shift. You come over in the evenings, and we'll give you simulators, these civilians, who knew as good as any instructor pilot how to, you know, because they knew the sim, you know, how to train sure. you, trick you and show you the tricks of everything. Well, so I probably got about, oh gosh, in a month, I bet I got easily 30 simulators that, you know, there was no time limit, and but no grade sheets to document all this.
Sure. That was the best sims ever.
So I come back to Okinawa, you know, with just a book that says he's passed all the written tests. And they say, okay, well, we're going to check you out here locally since TAC wouldn't do it. And so before you get in the airplane, you got to have your sim, your first sim, you know, go through basic engine start, emergency procedures. And Captain Deptula is my instructor. So we go over there. He briefs it up. I get in the sim and start the airplane, no problem. He's throwing emergencies at me, and I'm handling them really fast. And he keeps cranking things up, and I keep handling everything he's throwing at me. And I think I maybe even, you know, got airborne and say, hey, can I do an intercept? Because I was doing intercepts in the sim at Luke. And then we get out of the sim, and Dave was, he had this scowl on his face. And we get into the debrief session, and he starts filling out the grade sheet. And he's about halfway through, and finally puts his pencil down, and he looks at me and says, how did you do that? he says, this is your first simulator. And I go, well, not really. Yeah, but he says, I've never given anybody this good of grades on their first sim in my life. How did you pull that off? So I had to fess up that I probably had more sim time than most of the guys there.
That is awesome. Well, sir, yeah, I appreciate it. And this isn't the first time that you had the opportunity to fly a brand new airplane, which is pretty cool. But we'll talk about, I'm sure, that a little bit later. But so then fast forward a little bit. In 1984, you head off to the Air Force's test pilot school at Edwards. And you got to share with us, I don't think we've talked about that yet on the podcast, about what TPS is like. And also, you know, is that a goal that you had in mind from way back when? I mean, you already alluded to that you had known a test pilot. So I'd love to hear your motivations on TPS.
Yeah, so remember, my goal was to be a United Airline pilot, so no, it hadn't been. And, but again, another kind of providential circumstance, when I was a cadet at the Air Force Academy, I was studying engineering, and I can remember as my junior year there, I was thinking, you know, God, I really love engineering, but I'm going to go be a pilot. And, you know, you can be an English major and be a pilot, you can be a history major, you don't need to be an engineer to be a pilot. And once you go off to be a pilot, the odds of you using your engineering studies are pretty low. I mean, it may contribute a little bit, but not significantly. And I remember just kind of musing to myself that it's a shame that as much as I love engineering, I'm never going to get to use it again. Well, that summer between my junior and senior year, I got a phone call right near the end of the academic year in the spring from the department that I was assigned to, mechanics, and they said, how would you like to spend 6 weeks this summer at Edwards Air Force Base on a summer research project? Well, again, my motivations weren't too pure. I'm from Los Angeles. I had all my high school buddies were back there in Los Angeles, and you know, we only had 3 weeks of vacation at the academy in the summer, and so this was turning into 9 weeks of vacation the way I looked at it. You know, I'm gonna be able to just zip down to LA on the weekends and just have a great time, not knowing really what I was getting into. And so I go out there, and I'm assigned to the X-24B lifting body program, their last manned rocket program that, you know, where we took it up and dropped it off the B-52. So, you know, you think of X-1 all the way up through X-15, and now this is the X-24B model. John Mankey was a NASA test pilot. Mike Love, Lieutenant Colonel Mike Love, was the Air Force test pilot. I got to hang out with these guys, and I was working in, you know, taking data and plotting data on graphs was my job. But what I discovered were all these guys were pilots, and they were all engineers, and they all loved what they were doing. And so I came back to the academy going, wow, I can be a pilot and use my engineering education if I become a test pilot. So, you know, at that point I kind of said, all right, before I go fly for the airlines, I'll try to do that. If I can do that, then I'll stay in a little longer to do that. Then I'll go fly for the airlines. So that, you know, that's how I was introduced to that potential career path. And I set it as a goal, even when I was over flying R4s, that I said, you know, somehow, someday I want to try to see, at least apply to go to test pilot school.
That's awesome. Well, you know, I was thinking about, well, a lot of us in the story you just described, you know, from the movie The Right Stuff, this is kind of what you imagine the test pilot arena to be like, you know, dropping rockets off of big airplanes up at altitude and doing a lot of tests. But can you give us some fidelity on the truth to this? Is this really what it was like every day? What sort of missions did you do while you were out at TPS?
Yeah, so the when you're at the test pilot school as a student, it's a year-long program. It's a pretty intense program. And you learn all the hand-eye coordination, physical flying skills, but there's a lot of academics as well on aeronautics, you know, subsonic, supersonic, aero, flight controls, spin theory. I can go on and on. And typically, you'd get up in the morning, go in, and you'd either the morning was set aside for flying. Of course, it's the best time to fly in the high desert when the winds are kind of calm. So there would be an early go and a second go. You may or may not fly one of those two. But then all afternoon, you'd be in class and lecture. And then on Fridays were exams. And maybe not every Friday, but certainly every other Friday. And there was report writing, oral presentations, formal report presentations from little test projects that you did along the way. You learned how to do pitot-static calibration on an airplane, and you learned how to do handling qualities on an airplane. You got to fly all different kinds of airplanes. At that time, we flew the T-38, the F-4, the A-7, the A-37. Those were kind of the stable airplanes, and then any opportunity they had to bring in an airplane from another unit, they always wanted us to expose us to something we had never flown before, which was really fun. You know, you get the Dash 1 the day before, you'd study it and go out and fly it. And, you know, by the time you finished, you had this, I don't think it was a totally misplaced confidence, but if I could figure out how to strap into the ejection seat and if someone would start the engines for me, I could fly anything. That's what I felt, felt about it. You know, with proper preparation, studying it, but first time out of the chute, you could do it. And so that's kind of what the year is like. But then after that, you're off to be a test pilot. And at the time, there wasn't a lot of new airplanes being developed. It's certainly not in the white world. I think in 1984, when we finished, January of 85 is when I got my assignment to Eglin to do weapons testing. I think probably the only program in hindsight would have been the F-117. I don't think it'd come out. So that was happening unbeknownst to everybody. But at Edwards, it was mostly F-16s and F-15s. And down at Eglin, what we did, it was a great test squadron. We had seven different types of aircraft in one squadron. So F-15, F-16, F-4, A-10, F-111, helicopters, T-38 chase. And everybody was dual qualified. So I qualified in the F-4, and we had all models of the F-4 except the G. You know, Cs, Ds, and Es, some hard wings, some soft wings. And all models of the F-15. And we would test new radar tapes. We would test new air-to-air missiles. That was involved some air-to-air missile testing. New bombs. And, one thing about the Phantom, you could hang just about anything on it. So you may be developing a weapon for another weapon system, but you're making the first drops and functional tests off the F-4. So, being an RF-4 guy and then an air-to-air F-15 guy, I had to learn how to drop bombs. So that was fun. The other really interesting, neat thing about this squadron was it was not just made up of test pilots. We had a weapons school graduate, not a test pilot school graduate, but a weapons school graduate for each MDS or each type of aircraft in the squadron. So we had an F-15 weapons guy who he didn't grow up in the test world, but he grew up in the operational world. And so we were very focused on not only developing new systems, new weapon systems, integrating them into the platforms, but making sure they had operational utility as we handed them over to the force. And, at the end of the day, if you ask me what's more fun, going out and rat racing in an F-15 at Kanina, Okinawa, with guys like Dave Deptula or flying dissimilar air-to-air combat with the aggressors is a lot of fun. As far as, feeling like you've made a contribution, a long-term contribution, the satisfaction of knowing that you worked on something that eventually got into the hands of your fellow aviators and made a difference, even in combat, which some of the systems I've worked on I can say I know did, that's a different level of satisfaction in aviation. But it's a different kind of flying, kind of flying.
Well, sir, we could stop the tape right there, and this would be an incredible podcast, but you obviously didn't stop there. So a couple years of doing that, it's 1987, and you move from the Air Force to NASA 1 year after the Challenger disaster, which for those that were alive during that time, I'm sure they remember where they were when that unfortunate event happened. So, of course, that time of in 1987, the U.S. space program is having some serious introspection. So what drove you to want to make this move, and what was the environment like at NASA during that period?
Yeah, again, this was not part of my plan when I was a youngster. And even when I first arrived at Eglin Air Force Base, I remember in 1985, pre-Challenger, NASA was accepting applications for astronauts. And I remember right when I got there, one of the other test pilots asked me if I was going to apply, and I said, no. I didn't go to test pilot school to be an astronaut. I want to be a test pilot. And so I didn't apply that year. But one of my friends and teammates in the squadron, Brian Duffy, applied and got accepted. Well, you know, I kind of rolled the tape back here. When I checked out locally at Kadena in the F-15, I had gotten two rides from my ops officer in a two-seater, and then I soloed, and then he handed me off to young Captain Brian Duffy, who was a year ahead of me at the academy. We didn't know each other, but I knew of him because he had gotten an F-15 like Dave Deptula right out of pilot training. He was part of that cadre that came to Okinawa with one tour under his belt. And Brian just took me through the whole syllabus and checked me out. We became good friends in the 67 Tech Fighter Squadron. And then Brian's next assignment was to test pilot school. And I remember going to visit him while he was at school. I was home on leave and drove up to Edwards, and he seemed like he was having a good time, and that was kind of my goal. So I went to test pilot school. Well, Brian went to Eglin. Well, I got assigned to Eglin. And then he went to be an astronaut. So I was at this stage where, you know, it was time for me to go to staff college, step out of the cockpit. You know, I was kind of used to following Brian Duffy. I think that, you know, my name must have been right behind his at MPC there, at the personnel center. And so I called him up and I said, you know, so do you think I'd like doing what you're doing? He said, yeah, I think you would. I think you should apply. So I did. And I really wasn't sure I wanted to go do it because, you know, I loved being in the Air Force. You know, I loved what I was doing. Although I was facing a staff job, you know, that was, you know, maybe that was a bit of the motivation too. You know, desperate times call for desperate measures when you're young and think that the only thing that matters in life is flying airplanes, which is not right. I know now. But so anyway, I threw my hat in the ring. And but I do recall when I was fortunate enough to get interviewed. And that's a week-long process. And when I left the Johnson Space Center to go back to Eglin, I was so hoping that they would pick me because it just so appealed to me. Brian was right. I mean, it was new. When I evaluate myself on what motivates me, I like learning new things, and I like being part of a great team. This was certainly a huge opportunity to learn something really new, the space business, flying spaceships. And the NASA team looked terrific to me, too, and certainly the Air Force team was great. So it was a win-win position for me. I, you know, if they picked me, I won. If they didn't pick me, I won. And it couldn't have been a better spot, and I was fortunate to get picked. I think part of the reason, you know, just to be honest, think about this. Challenger tragedy happened in January of 86 of that year. NASA announces they're going to select a class that spring, as much, I think, to send a signal that we're not dead. We're coming back. You know, we're committed to coming back from this. But one might imagine that the number of people who applied the year I applied is not nearly like the number of people that would be applying right now. In this last class, I think they selected from over maybe 15,000 applicants. I don't know what the number was in my class, but I'm sure it wasn't. There weren't as many people lining up to fly the space shuttle after we lost our great crew on Challenger.
Yeah, what an amazing time that you've been involved in this aerospace history. And sir, we could do 100 podcasts talking about your astronaut journey and still have 100 more podcasts to go to catch up. So I really appreciate this. And I want to touch on, if you don't mind, just walking us through the basics of what it was like, you know, the process in terms of training, any of the flight assignments, and working your way up the ladder to become a commander of one of the space shuttle missions.
Sure. You know, I was naive. When I showed up, I thought, you know, how hard can this be? I've checked out in the RF-4, I've checked out in the F-15, I've flown a bunch of different airplanes as a test pilot school. You know, space shuttle ought to be a pretty easy thing to check out in. I'll grab a couple of rides and go back to the Air Force. Well, a couple of things I learned right away. The space shuttle was the most complicated system I've ever had to learn, and it was not easy, frankly, for me. Other people it may have been easier for them, but it was incredibly complicated. And it is because it's at least three vehicles, if not four, rolled into one. It's a rocket ship that, when the engines quit, turns into a spaceship, and that's different. They can do rendezvous, proximity operations stuff. When it comes back to Earth, it's a hypersonic glide vehicle. You know, we talk about boost glide today, boost cruise. That's what we were. And then it turns into a really, really bad glider at endgame that you have to land dead stick on a runway. And all the systems and the software, the tightly integrated nature of the system was challenging. And so, you had to, so NASA, though, I thought had a great training program at the time. You know, it first started out with single systems, one at a time. So you learned about the reaction control system. You got lectured on it by the engineers who designed it. Then you got lectured on, took lectures from the mission operations folks that we're gonna, you're going to talk to in mission control when you're operating it. And then you got a lecture from an astronaut who'd actually flown and had some practical experiences and insights on that. And then you would sit down in a trainer, a simulator that was called a single system trainer, and all the, they'd run you through all the normal procedures for launch, on orbit, and reentry with that system, and then all the abnormal procedures. And after you'd done that, you moved on to the next system, and you learned the APU system. And then you did the same for the orbital maneuvering, main engines, electric system, fuel cell systems, computer systems, flight control systems. And then, and that took about a year to get the 15 of us in our class through that. And then, after a year, you were finally at a point where you could get in the shuttle simulator for the first time and try to integrate all these systems together and start learning how to make it work in both nominal, we'd say, normal conditions and emergency conditions. And that's where you really got to appreciate the complexity of the vehicle.
Sure. Well, Sarah, I really hate to even do this to you, but I know that the audience wants to know, and it's so basic for a guy with your experience, but for us normal humans here, what is an actual launch like when you are sitting in the seat of the space shuttle?
Well, it's violent is a good term to use. It's also thrilling and exciting. A lot of emotions all wrapped up in one. But I can also say that on every one of my flights, I felt so well prepared by the training team at the Johnson Space Center, by the work we had done together as a crew, the trust we had with each other in the crew, on the team, that whether I was leading it or as the pilot to my commander, once I got strapped into the vehicle, I fell asleep. Waiting for everybody else to get strapped in. I mean, I was that relaxed. And, of course, you wake up at least an hour before launch. But, I mean, I was really sanguine about this, not because I was overconfident, but because I had this sense of confidence from the great training I'd received. And, you know, you don't know what you don't know. I mean, there's some things you just cannot control. The Challenger crew cannot control what happened to them, nor could the Columbia crew. But you know that if that happens, that happens. But if there's something that can be within your control, you feel prepared to deal with that. And you have this other sense that because you get to know not only the other astronauts, but all the people in mission control. I had worked for a couple of years down at the Kennedy Space Center supporting launch operations. You get to know those people, and you know their passion, and you know in your heart that everything humanly possible has been done to make your flight not only safe but successful in accomplishing the mission. And when you know that, you can fall asleep on a launch pad. But then you know, as you get closer to launch, things get a little, the pucker factor goes up, if you will. I'd say, though, that again, because of the training, you were just locked in on what it is you were supposed to be doing from the moment the clock went to zero until 8.5 minutes later when the engines quit. And you were just focused on that. At the same time, you know, you had to enjoy the moment too. So look out the window every now and then on the way uphill and see what that looked like. The physical piece, there's no simulator on Earth that can simulate the start of the shuttle main engines at the time. And so when they fired up at T-minus 6 seconds, the vibration was incredible. And then when the solid rockets motors lit 6 seconds later, then you were just crushed back in your seat by about three times the force of gravity as you sprung off the pad. And I think the thing that struck me most was, so we've all been in really fast jets maybe, or fast cars where you jump on the accelerator and you get pushed back in the seat. I guarantee it's never 3 Gs, but whatever it is, you don't stay pushed back very long. But here you get pushed back, and for the next 2 minutes you stay pushed back on those solid rocket motors and at three wow. Gs, and you're just... You know, you're looking at the velocity going up at a rate that you just can't believe, and that continues to be the experience. When they come off, the acceleration goes down a bit, but then it builds right back up to 3 Gs for the last minute, and you're screaming, and you know it just by looking at the gauges. You don't know it by looking out the window, but you're watching the speedometer, for lack of a better word, go just racing as you're getting up toward ultimately 17,500 miles an hour or something I can sort of wrap my head around is 5 miles a second is how fast you're moving when the engines quit from zero in 8.5 minutes.
Well, sir, I was a little worried asking you that question just because I know you get it so much, but I'm so glad that I asked it, and I really appreciate you describing in detail what it was like to experience those liftoffs.
And if I could add one more thing, like just to kind of capture the feeling, I mean, you're really focused and everything, and when the engines quit, I remember I looked over at Dan Brandenstine, my commander on my first flight, STS-49, and I said to him, what every kid says after their first ride on a roller coaster, said, hey, Dad, can we do that again? Because it was just spectacular. You know, you're like your first roller coaster ride where you screamed and yelled, and then you got off and went, man, I want to get back in line and have that thrilling experience again.
Well, sir, and you got to do it two more times, which is absolutely phenomenal. And I'm sure that things were different the first time compared to the third time. So would you mind to share just a little bit of how you compare, you know, maybe even duties that you had for the three different missions that you did?
Sure. On the first two missions, I was the pilot, which is kind of NASA language for co-pilot. So, you know, if you think about an airliner, I'm in the right seat. And the captain of the airliner, we call the commander at NASA, is in the left seat. And the commander is the commander of the crew. You know, the burden of command lies on the commander's shoulder. And she or he, you know, there's a different feeling when you're sitting in the left seat than when you're sitting in the right seat. You know, everybody wants to get their job done. But when you feel that the burden of responsibility for the whole flight, and it's the commander who lands the shuttle at the end. You know, the pilot, the co-pilot, is working systems for him, puts the landing gear down, drags you down. If you touch down, calls out airspeeds and altitudes, has an important role. But, you know, if the landing doesn't work out, the whole world's watching, and you got one chance to get that right. So, you know, there's a different focus there. And interestingly, the way the shuttle was designed intentionally is, I would argue, the hardest job as far as learning systems is the pilot's job, the co-pilot's job, because all of the systems that can kill you or save your life that you might have to adjust on launch or reentry are on that side of the cockpit. And that was by design because they wanted to unburden the commander in the left seat to be able to pay attention to the big picture, which is how are we doing on the trajectory? What are we going to do if we lose an engine now? How about now? How about now? And that changes from liftoff throughout that 8.5 minutes, whether you're going to do a return to launch site abort, turn around, fly backwards at Mach 6 and thrust back to the Cape and dead stick it into the Cape right after liftoff, or abort forward and land in Spain, or abort to orbit, a lower orbit than design, or abort once around and end up landing in New Mexico maybe on your first orbit. All those things, yeah, that's the big important picture stuff the commander needs to be paying attention to. And if you got a hydraulic leak or an electrical short, or a problem with the main engines or something else, you need someone else to be worrying about that stuff. And that's what the pilot did. So the pilot side was really, in training in particular, where they're throwing all kinds of malfunctions at you, you really had to know the systems well. And there was time-critical things you had to do. So just, you know, kind of give you a sense of the difference between the co-pilot and pilot responsibilities. And I flew as the co-pilot or pilot on my first two flights and then commanded my last flight. Flights were very different and all fantastic. The first one was a satellite rescue mission, STS-49. There was a satellite that was supposed to be in geosynchronous that was stuck in low Earth orbit. To keep it alive on launch, they had to separate it from its engine that would take it to geosynchronous. So we carried aboard the Space Shuttle Endeavour on her maiden voyage, as well as mine, a brand new rocket motor rendezvoused with the satellite. And it's an interesting mission if you Google it. We had a lot of trouble. We had trained to do it a certain way for over a year and a half, and we got up there and that way didn't work. And we had to do some real-time problem solving and totally throw the plan out the window and replan and do some things that had never been thought of or done before to actually complete the mission. And we did, which, you know, I'm very, very proud to be part of that team that pulled that off. And it was a total effort, not just the crew on board, the mission control and everybody else. Second flight was more of an Earth resources flight where we were studying the Earth with a large synthetic aperture radar doing imagery. So this is 1994. We're taking pictures of the Earth. What was cool is the places we took pictures of on the Earth were different environments, you know, from boreal forests to deserts to watershed areas in Oklahoma, and it was all over the world. And scientists had gone out to these sites and studied what they really looked like. what the real ground truth was. They put radar reflectors out there, and then we took pictures from space with a radar, and then they could say, well, what does the radar see when it's looking at an arid area or looking at a forest that has a disease? And it turned out to be the start of what turned into three missions. And by the time they finished with the Space Radar Lab on its third mission, I just was fortunate to fly on the first, NASA had mapped the entire land mass of the Earth between 57 north and south latitudes for the first time, all the way to ground level with 10-meter accuracy. So wow. You can imagine, you know, if you think about the jungles in the Mayan Peninsula, they found, you know, Mayan temples under the jungles that no one knew were there, for example. Many other things, because the radar could penetrate all the way to the ground through foliage and determine what was underneath all those trees and bushes. It could also bounce off the different frequencies, could also bounce off the top of the trees and then go halfway down as well. So that's why we could collect all this interesting data on health of certain environments, but also geography, geology. Amazing mission. And then my last mission was very surreal, being a cold warrior, because, you know, that's where I'd spend most of my time and mindset in the RF-4 and the F-15. And now it's 1996, and we're preparing to build the International Space Station. We haven't started yet. And peace has broken out. The Soviet Union's gone away, and Russia has a space station. And NASA makes a deal with Russia to help keep their space agency alive, but also to our benefit. We knew we were going to use the space shuttle to build the International Space Station. We figured we could learn a lot from the Russians. And so they agreed to allow us to come up and first build a docking adapter that was delivered and then dock the space shuttle to the Mir space station. So here I am. I'm actually pinching myself while I'm doing this. My pilot, Rick Searfoss, was an F-111 driver in the Cold War. He sat alert at Lincoln Heath with nuclear weapons ready to drop them on the heads of anybody on the other side of the East German border. On that side of the border, sitting alert in a MiG-23 was the backup commander for this trip to Mir, who we trained with, and his job was to shoot Rick down. I, on the other hand, was flying Eagles in Okinawa, Korea, and if we'd gotten a dust-up with the Soviets, we was going to have to handle anybody that came out of Vladivostok. Well, the commander for the mission to Mir was flying Su-17s over there at the same time I was. So here we are, you know, opposite sides of the chessboard for most of our careers, and now we're training together to accomplish a space mission. And it was pretty amazing, going to Star City, having to learn enough Russian to be able to read checklists and carry on a little bit of polite conversation. Two key words, fire and leak, you know, that are common to, you know, common big emergencies that you have on any space vehicle. And to go up there and do that. So we rendezvoused and docked with the Mir space station. We took up my crewmate, Dr. Shannon Lucid, and transferred a bunch of equipment over and transferred Shannon. So for a while there, I probably do still have the record. I was the first commander in the history of NASA to return from space with fewer astronauts than he launched with, which most of the time would have gotten you fired. but in this case, that was our mission. And Shannon stayed aboard Mir for over 4 months before another shuttle crew brought her back. And it was, I'm proud to have been part of that effort.
Well, it's incredible, sir. And like, I hate to even have to move on and ask you more questions, because I just want to hear more and more of where your stories are going. But for the interest of time, we'll fast forward a little bit. So in 1998, you head back to the Air Force as the Deputy Director of Operations at the Air Force's Space Command. I mean, you kind of alluded to, you know, the changes that you've seen in the political landscape and things like that. But what did the national security community's priorities in space look like back then? Just wondering what their objectives, challenges, and opportunities were looking like.
Yeah, Slick, before I answer that, can I tell you a quick story that I think is important?
Please do.
It's an important leadership story. So I mentioned when I naively first came to NASA, I thought I just, you know, how hard can this be? I'll bag a few flights, go back to the Air Force, keep flying F-15s. And one, I was wrong technically on what it would require to train up to go fly. But two, kind of the sense in the Air Force was, you went off to do this, have a nice life, you know, at NASA. We were still in the Air Force. We were Air Force astronauts, but we were wearing polo shirts and khakis to work every day and worked for NASA. We did not have a we were, for administrative purposes, you know, our records were at various times held at Air Force Systems Command, then the Pentagon for a while, and I think by the time I had shown up in 1987, they'd moved our records to be taken care of at Air Force Space Command at Peterson. And we had, you know, the question had been asked after Challenger by some of the more senior colonels there that had flown on shuttle, is there opportunities for us to come back to the Air Force? And the answer was no. And I understood the reasons for that. You know, they'd been there 9 years. They hadn't been squadron commanders. They hadn't been group commanders. They hadn't gone to Armed Forces Staff College or War College. They had Pentagon staff tours. And why would we take the opportunity to command at the 06 level or fill an important staff job at the 06 level away from someone who had done all those things in Air Force Space Command and give it to you? That was kind of the attitude. And when I heard that, one, I was disappointed because they were essentially saying you'll never come back to the Air Force. But two, I understood it at the time. And again, this is the late 80s rolling into the 1990s. Well, roll the clock forward 9 years later. And by the way, that message was delivered from the commander of Space Command who had come to visit us. It was asked and delivered the question. 9 years later, the commander of Space Command, so several commanders later, comes down to visit his Air Force astronauts. And I'm kind of thinking, I've been to this rodeo, except now I'm the old guy. And it's General Joe Ashy. And General Ashy came down. And what was interesting is, like his predecessor, three times removed, when he had come down, he had told us what the missions were in Space Command and what they were doing. When General Ashy came down, gave the same speech. Not much had changed since 1987 to 1996 of what Air Force Space Command was doing. I mean, over the horizon communications, missile warning, space situational awareness, GPS, weather, even still then, we were doing weather satellites. Not much had changed. And but General Ashy said, you know, we're trying to operationalize this command. And that all began at the very beginning, I'm sure. Every commander, even before me at Air Force Space Command, knew someday we would be where we are today. Which is, you know, recognizing space as a warfighting domain, because humans haven't found a domain not to fight in the history of mankind. And we all understood right. this. But you know, the policymakers just, by and large, for various reasons, weren't there. But General Ashy came down and he said, look, I'll never forget this. He looked at us after telling us what to do. He says, look, I know none of you guys have been squadron commanders, never been to ACSC, never been to war cards. He went down the same list. He said, I know you've never done any of those things. But he says, you're the only people in the United States Air Force who have been in the domain. And I think there's value in that. And I want you to know, I'll never make you leave NASA. But if you want to come back in the Air Force, the door's open. And this is something he did on his own, you know, General Ashy. He opened this door for not just me, but anyone who wanted to come back. I happened to be the only one who volunteered at the time to come back. And again, that was just because of, as a family. I started my family late. Our kids were young and little. My colleagues who had come there when I came in 9 years earlier, they had kids in high school. They had a great job working on a great team. Dislocating the family at that point, having not been used to that, was going to be tough. I, on the other hand, married to a wonderful woman who grew up as an Air Force brat, was an active duty officer. We met at test pilot school. We were classmates. She got it. We both loved the Air Force. And our children were very young. They were 2, 4, 6, and 8. And we said we wanted our children to experience what it's like to be in the United States Air Force, to be back in the Air Force family, where you can live on an Air Force base and stay out till the streetlights come on, where, you know, you're part of this community that welcomes. You don't look forward to moving, but when you're moving, you know you're going to get caught by a bunch of people who have the same experience and going to look after you. And we wanted our children to know what that was like. And frankly, I, you know, was at a point where I had achieved my personal goals at NASA, having flown 3 times and commanded. And then I had the opportunity to work on the International Space Station program, which was incredibly, I had no idea how much that prepared me to return to the Air Force. And so, you know, like I said, I volunteered, and thankfully the Air Force took me back, which started really a third career for me, I guess. You know, 11 years as an operator, operational pilot and test pilot, and then 11 years as an astronaut and deputy program, 9 as an astronaut, 2 as a deputy program manager, and then closed out my career as 13 years back in the Air Force. So what was different when I came back in 1998 in the Air Force? Well, I'll tell you what was on the radar screen was launch, because we had just blown up, I think, 3 rockets, K-1, carrying very expensive payloads.
Okay.
And so that was a big deal. It was also the time period we're talking about EELV. That was that program, that competition was ginning up. And follow on to DSP, you know, DSP Constellation. So the early stages of the SBIRS program were starting. And remember, I'm at Air Force Space Command. I'm the Deputy Director of Operations. And was the billet they kind of invented for me to figure out how to re-blue this guy who's, you know, been freeze-dried at NASA for the last 11 years. You know, I was like Encino Man, you know, thawed out and wake up. And fortunately, what I found out is there's about an 11-year cycle in the Air Force, and things that, as I parachuted back in, that people were saying, oh, my gosh, this is new and different. I went, no, that's the way we used to do it. And so I parachuted back in at about the right time to come back in to hear leadership say we should be doing things the same way I remember we did it when I was a major. So that was easy for me in that regard. That didn't seem like a radical change to me. And, you know, change is hard on any organization. But for me, it wasn't change. It was just, you know, of course, that's the way you do things. And so that those were just some observations. The hardest part of my decision, I say personally, is for someone who's as passionate about flying as I am, is I figured I'm going back to Air Force Space Command. I'm going to be a space guy. That's why we went back there. There are no airplanes in Air Force Space Command. So, you know, at the 20-year point here now, I've been blessed to fly my entire career. I'm going to go back and never fly again. Well, 9 months after I land at Space Command, I get orders to be the wing commander at Beale Air Force Base, where I not only got to fly the U-2, but the T-38. And I thought, oh, my gosh, what's going on here? But you know, I'm not complaining.
So I'm really glad that you stopped me there and clarified the fact that going back to the Air Force was different. But, you know, really thinking about this, it is the best thing that the Air Force could have done, especially with hindsight being what it is and where we sit today. So you go back to the Air Force, which was definitely non-traditional based on what you've explained to us. And now you switch from being an operator into a strategic leader across the board. So you go commanding the 9th Reconnaissance Wing, leading the 8th Air Force, a few Pentagon tours. You come back to Space Command as the commander in 2006, and then obviously Strategic Command. So can you talk us through from a strategic level what you experienced at the third part of your career, as you mentioned, to where we are today?
Sure. But I begin by first saying, you know, that none of this wouldn't happen if I didn't work for great leaders. And one of the attributes of great leaders is that they either have a gut feeling or they're willing to roll the dice and take a chance. And I think probably in my case was maybe a little bit of both. But people gave me opportunities that I never dreamed I would have. I mean, like I said, I thought I was coming back to work as a space, you know, senior officer in space. And 9 months later, I'm off to command the 9th Reconnaissance Wing. My goodness. You know, what? I used to joke with my team there at flying U-2s, I'd say, yeah, it's really great to be back in low altitude reconnaissance, you know, having flown the space shuttle. They got a chuckle out of that. But, you know, I thought, surely they sent me here because they saw a picture of me in a launch and entry suit, which is the same suit that the U-2 guys wear. There has to be some mistake here. They must think I know something. I know I don't. But, you know, and then from there, my Pentagon jobs, you know, every pilot swears they'll never want to go to the Pentagon. Man, were they amazing jobs. Again, positions I knew nothing about. You know, they'd give me orders there, and I'd say, okay, what do they do? What's that job? And, you know, it turns out I'm doing political military affairs on the joint staff on 9/11, and my AOR is Asia Pacific and the Middle East. And next thing you know, I'm in Islamabad. And a few months later in December, I'm doing a foot reconnaissance at Kabul. And I'm supposed to be sitting behind a gray desk in the Pentagon. I'm going, man, this is as exciting as anything I've ever done and not what I expected. My Pentagon time was pretty incredible. Hard work, but worthy work. And then to come back and get to fly, you know, check out in the B-52 and command our strategic air-breathing forces, and all our reconnaissance forces at the time were in the 8th Air Force and then Space Command. You know, we were still under the gag order not to talk about it as a warfighting domain. And I'd watched my predecessors who, you know, believed as strongly as I did that it wasn't. Every time they tried to push that, it seemed like our budgets were cut. So my focus when I came into Space Command was, okay, we're not going to talk about space superiority. We're not going to talk about warfighting in space. But I know the first thing every commander needs and wants is situational awareness on the battle space they're responsible for conducting operations in. So that's going to be our focus. We're going to organize, train, and equip. But the stuff we're going to clean sheet and go after how we're going to do space domain awareness. We didn't call it that at that time, but that was kind of the focus area there. And then STRATCOM, you know, when after 9/11 they shut down U.S. Space Command, which had been operating for over 10 years, and gave that mission to STRATCOM. I guess, you know, they decided because I'd done some nuclear, ICBMs at Space Command, B-52s at 8th Air Force, and B-2s, because I knew space. We had that mission, and I had actually, at 8th Air Force, I was quadruple-hatted. One of my hats was commander of Air Force Cyber, believe it or not, in 2005. We were still trying to figure out how to do that, and they gave it to Mikey down at 8th Air Force. So I had a little bit of those three mission sets, and that was the three big missions at STRATCOM, was nuclear deterrence, space, and cyber. And we had other important missions in integrating missile defense, electronic warfare, combating weapons of mass destruction. But, you know, our line authority missions that were, in my view, where I had component commanders assigned and forces assigned to do those missions were nuclear, space, and cyber. And, you know, when I left the Air Force, we didn't have computers on our desk. And that's how fast the world had changed in one career.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, sir. And I think, you know, one of the key themes that we talk about, especially when we talk about space being a warfighting domain, although many folks anticipated it and thought about it and considered what the future would be like, is we forget that the enemy has a vote, right? And so in 2007, when we saw the ASAT from China, and of course, we just saw Russia, you know, shoot down a satellite and those types of things, you know, our hand was kind of forced, as we've talked about. So now space is a warfighting domain and we have a space force. And just asking you, wrapping up, this has been such a great discussion, but if you had to summarize where we find ourselves today in the national security space realm, looking at challenges and opportunities, how do you describe the situation?
Well, I'd say we have a lot of catching up to do, and because there's across-the-board capabilities, and, you know, the Space Force is doing, they're working really hard to identify the gaps and seams, you know, where the divots are that need to be filled in, and not only to catch up, but to put us in a position that we are used to being in every other domain, where no one dare take us on in those domains because they know we will win. And that's the essence of deterrence. They have to believe that if they cross a line, they're going to lose. They're either going to lose something of value or they're going to absolutely fail on whatever their mission objective is. And I don't think we're exactly there in the space domain yet, in my humble opinion. And, you know, I just do that by observation of what I read in the newspaper and see what our potential adversaries in China and Russia are doing. And it's not to be unexpected. It's no one's fault that's wearing the uniform today in the Space Force. We weren't even allowed to talk about this as recent as 5 years ago. And building a service at the same time while you're trying to build capability, you know, it's like fixing an airplane or on the fly while you're up in the air. And you're building it, fixing it, building, adding capabilities. And our adversaries have demonstrated some capabilities, and in the case of China, fielded capabilities that we haven't been allowed to do. But now we are. So we ought to get on with it. And we need to look at it through the lens of deterrence. And the way you deter someone is you make sure that they realize if they cross that threshold, they come after our systems in space, we're not only going to do our best to defend them, we're going to destroy yours. The worst case scenario is we fight on a battlefield where we have no space capability and our adversaries has all theirs because we don't field offensive capability to hold them at risk. If we don't lose that fight, which I think we would, frankly, we'll certainly lose a lot of sailors and airmen and soldiers and Marines who will die because they don't have GPS, they don't have over-the-horizon comm, they don't have satellite ISR from space, and the adversaries do, and you have to be able to hold them at risk. So, you know, we need to be thinking about the space domain the way we think about every other domain. You know, the Air Force supports the Army with close air support, but they don't do it till they have air superiority. You can't send A-10s in without air superiority, or else they're going to get shot down. And so we got to get space superiority first. And how do you do that? Every commander's first question is, what's on the other side of that hill? So, number one, you got to have situational awareness, which is what I tried to emphasize, because who could be against situational awareness even back in 2006? And that's built on a foundation of intelligence, gathering collections. I always said, I want to know what that satellite looks like before it takes off, which means you got to penetrate the adversary's system, whether it's electronically or physically or whatever, or through, you know, human, whatever kind of hint to find out before it goes up. And if we can't, I want to get a picture of it on orbit, and I want us, our engineers, to figure out what they're doing with it, just like we did in the Cold War with FTD when we got our first pictures of a new Soviet fighter on the ramp. We put intelligence officers who knew aeronautics and knew airplanes and could estimate the range performance of that just from photographs. We need that in space. And you don't just sprinkle fairy dust and that appears tomorrow. You got to grow the expertise, which is why I think it's important for NASIC to have a dedicated space element there that is properly manned with the proper technical expertise to be able to analyze what our adversaries are doing in the domain. You got to be able to surveil the domain. You got to be able to keep track of what's up there, what's blue, what's red, what's gray. You know, what are the friendlies, who are the neutrals, and who are the bad guys? And you want to know what the heck they're doing up there. You also want to be able to do reconnaissance from space. You know, this notion that just the NRO does reconnaissance, I think, is wrong. I think the Space Force needs to be able to support the regional combatant commanders with more imagery from space, more signals intelligence in space that they can collect, because there's this huge demand factor out there that requires that they need to make operational and tactical level decisions in wartime that are not national level types of things. So they don't need pictures that can count the number of screws on a tank, but they need to know if there's a tank there or not. And if they drop a bomb on it, they need to know if the tank is gone. That's a different level of requirements. And the former is an important capability. But we can proliferate reconnaissance platforms in space that have lower capability than the exquisite satellites that we place for national intelligence collection, and meet the needs of the combatant commander. And that's what they need, is revisit rates and pictures on demand when they need them that are operationally significant. You know, the whole concept of force design, when you think about air power, that started in 1920s at Maxwell Air Force Base, when people were thinking about bombers and strategic bombardment and how you would equip them with self-defense capabilities and stuff back when we were flying biplanes. I mean, that thought went in, 15 years before World War II, and we developed, based on those thoughts, a force structure that fortunately was ready to go by 1942, and then demonstrate whether the theory worked. None of that work's been done yet because we weren't allowed to, and now we need to do it. And so we need a dedicated team that's doing not only how we build more resilient satellite constellations in the future, but offensive capability that holds adversary satellite at risk, space to space, air to space, sea to space, and ground to space. We need support from component commanders to gain and maintain space superiority, just as we do in the air domain when we rely on the Army with their Patriot capability, et cetera, to augment our air-to-air capability that we bring to gain superiority. We need command and control capability, both at the tactical and operational level, that integrates into combatant commanders' plans and operations in the event of war. So those are organizational constructs that need to be stood up. All of these groups, whether they're at the tactical level or at the operational level, command and control levels, need to have training facilities and simulators like I had at NASA that teach us how to not just deal with natural problems when a battery fails or a solar event happens, but when an adversary is trying to hunt you down and kill you, your system. How are you going to defend against that? How are you going to have a robust architecture that continues to operate when you start being attrited by an adversary, but also how you hold them at risk. And we need the appropriate level of simulation, training, modeling and simulation, and equipment, again, both at the tactical and operational level of war, so that we can integrate space into everybody's exercises, war games, and tactics, techniques, and development processes. We need assured access to the domain. We talk about repopulating constellations when they come under attack. Well, if you got two fixed launch sites, those are going to be easy. Those are going to be vulnerable. So how do we look at more expeditionary operations, if you will, on U.S. soil or off U.S. soil, or air-breathing launches to put up what you need in time of war when you have to flex? We need a robust industrial base. We need S&T that's focused on this, so research institutions, you know, like AFRL, that really is powered up and focusing on the needs of the Space Force to do their missions. We need a robust test capability, like we have at Nellis for air power. We can test at Edwards. We can test operationally at Nellis. We have training ranges there. We need to be thinking about how we're going to train our operators in realistic environments, so we give them the 10 missions that you get at red flag before you go to war, so that you don't show up without any experience and that type of a conflict. Space needs that as well. They need their 10 missions of red flag of that everybody that's sitting on console operating a satellite, they need to be tested. How they're going to defend that satellite, how they're going to operate that satellite. And if they have the offensive mission, how they're going to conduct operations against a smart thinking adversary who's trying not to be destroyed. Intelligence down at the unit level. We had an intelligence officer assigned that briefed us on threats daily when I was flying the RF-4 as a second lieutenant, first lieutenant, and the F-15 as a captain. We had an intel officer who told us what the heck was going on the other side of the fence at the squadron level. So at the SOPS level, that's the kind of level I would think that you would want to support. They need to be fresh in understanding that. And we need some cyber capability because everything we do in space is linked back to cyber. These are just some of my top-level thoughts, but if I could wrap a ribbon around it, Slick, I'd say the default position is we should treat this domain like we treat every other domain. And look what the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps demand to provide ready forces to the combatant commanders. We ought to demand the same things. And then eliminate them by exception when there are exceptional cases. But we don't begin by easing into this. We put out a list of requirements right up front and work hard to get them funded.
Well, sir, I'm blown away. My pencil is smoking as I'm taking notes here for future conversations that I'm sure we will have. And I can't tell you enough how appreciative we are to have you on the Aerospace Advantage podcast as an introductory episode to let our audience know who you are and what you bring to the table, because it's obvious that it is unmatched from an experience and a leadership perspective. So we are so grateful to have you here at Mitchell and really, really look forward to the next time we get a chance to chat on the podcast.
Well, thanks, Slick. You're too kind. When I reflect on what my skills are, it's not that I'm eminently trainable, and I've had some great leaders and I've been mentored from above and I've been mentored from below. And I'll always look for those opportunities to learn from the other experts we have here at Mitchell that are really passionate about helping out get America where we need to be in the space domain. So thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, our listeners, for your continued support. And thank you for tuning in today. We've got a lot of new and exciting content coming your way, including some deep dives on space capabilities, followed by another installment of our monthly roundtable, The Rendezvous. This year, we're headed out to air and space events near you, so don't forget to follow or subscribe to the podcast. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or LinkedIn to find out where we'll be and what the Mitchell team has in our sight picture. And please, don't forget to leave us a rating. Hit the like button and follow or subscribe to the Aerospace Advantage. Also, leave us a comment to let us know what you think about our podcast and let us know areas you think we should explore further. Please visit us at MitchellAerospacePower.org to read the latest reports, events, and analysis that are charting the vectors for our air and space forces. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Stay safe and check six.